Welcome, welcome everyone to the masterclass for this week. Let's see, 8 p.m., December 21st, 2023. I'm already confused and I got to turn to 24 just around the corner. This will be our last one for this 2023. Let's make it a blast. And I'm so looking forward to all of these presentations this evening. We have some really good ones. And let's get going. First on the agenda tonight is Brian Weaver. Are you ready?
I am ready. Let me start my stream.
Take it away.
Can everyone see my screen?
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, good evening, everyone. My name is Brian Weaver, and welcome to this presentation titled Credential Access, a Pivotal Step in an Attacker's Plan. If you have any questions, feel free to ask them at the end, as there will be a question section. So let's get started. This presentation is going to go over multiple different topics, including a new phrase regarding modern IT infrastructure, common credential access attacks, as well as mitigations to these attacks. So a lot to cover, but let's get started. So first, let's talk about the phrase, identity is the new perimeter. This is a phrase you may see on Isaka and Microsoft's websites, but what does it mean? Well, what it means is that no longer are companies depending only on their internal IT resources. If we think about it, 20, 25 years ago, everything, including web server, database servers, et cetera, were inside the company's physical infrastructure. But that's no longer the case. With software as a service solutions such as Microsoft 365 and Google Workspace, infrastructure as a service solutions such as Azure, AWS, and Google Cloud Platform, as well as cloud storage solutions such as Box, Dropbox, and OneDrive, companies are becoming increasingly dependent on these external providers. But what's the difference between a physical infrastructure and a software as a service solution? Well, instead of a physical infrastructure having security guards, cameras, et cetera, all you need to get into an AWS account is an email and a password. And this is the fundamental reason why attackers will want to attack these credentials, as soon as you get access to an email and password to, let's just say, the global administrator account, you potentially have access to all of the servers on a, for an example, an Azure IT infrastructure. So that is what this presentation is going to discuss, the different forms of credential access attacks described in MITRE's attack framework. This is not going to be an exhaustive list, as attackers are getting very smart these days, but just a little bit, just so we can get an understanding of some of the common attacks out there. If anyone wants to see any more information about this, MITRE has a great attack framework that is available for anyone to view. So the first form of attack is a password cracking attack. Now, this attack requires that a threat actor has a hash to crack the passwords of a user. Now, this is an important distinguishment. So let's first talk about what a hash is. A hash is a one-way cryptographic algorithm that takes a plain text, for an example, password, and converts it to an irreversible string. The benefit of using a hash, it's not encryption in terms of, it's not encryption in terms of where you can decrypt and encrypt over and over again. But a hash is meant for the secure storage of, for an example, passwords, in which, let's just say you had a database administrator, you do not want them to see the underlying passwords for all of the user accounts. So hashes are a great thing in security, but they also have a fundamental issue. Hashes are consistent. If you take the same plain text, it will always result in the same hash. Now, if you use a salt, it will randomize it, but that's still not foolproof. And this means that an attacker, even though I said earlier that a hash is a one-way cryptographic algorithm, an attacker can just guess and hash this over and over again. Of course, you could do this manually, but it would take a very prolonged period of time. But with modern IT computing, you can attempt 10,000 to 1 billion passwords per second. So if you have a password that's in the top 10,000, for instance, potentially your password can be cracked in less than a second or a few seconds, which is why password policies, which we'll get into later, is such an important aspect. Now, an attacker can also utilize multiple different methods to crack passwords in order to decrease the amount of time it takes to crack a password. First, you have dictionary attacks, which utilize a list. This is could be very effective because we know users use the same passwords. So if you just get a top 1,000 password list, you could potentially crack many passwords just without even having to go through a long ordeal. However, that's not always successful, so some attackers will use a brute force attack, a pure brute force attack, which will attempt every single password possible. So it will start at maybe one character and two characters, and it will just keep going. It can take pretty much an unlimited amount of time if necessary. And then, of course, you have a hybrid attack, which will actually use both. Actually, on the right side of your screen is an actual screenshot that I took of utilizing a password cracker named John the Ripper to crack the root password on a Linux system. This was actually in Try Hack Me, and anyone can actually attempt the same as well. Now, on a completely different end of the spectrum, you have something called a password spraying attack. This attack is different than a password cracking attack in that you don't need any hashes. Instead, the attacker is going to exploit the fact that many users still use common passwords. According to NordPass, the still the most common password, surprisingly, is 123456. So instead of going through all the exhaustive work of trying to crack a hash, why don't you just attempt the easiest passwords with hundreds or thousands of users? And potentially one of them will stick. And that is what attackers will do. And this is something that is another reason why password spraying is also very effective, is because an attacker will only attempt a few passwords, maybe three or five. The reason for this is that because they're only attempting a few passwords, it will never alert that an account lockout. Because if you try 20 or 30, okay, we're going to lock your account because you're trying too much. But because you're only trying maybe two or three, but with thousands of users, you won't raise any alarms, and potentially you can break into a few accounts. So this is also an attack that is prevalent and should be watched out for if you're a security professional. Another form of attack is called a credential stuffing attack. Now, this is another one that's also prevalent and was actually utilized in a recent hack as well. This attack exploits the problem that many people reuse their passwords. We know that over 60% of users reuse passwords. And of course, this was a survey, so most likely people is more than this, but people didn't want to admit it. And what will end up happening is, let's just say we have an example of Staples. Let's just say Staples, which was actually recently hacked, but nothing regarding passwords. But let's just say Staples was hacked. And in this database, a attacker successfully figures out that John Doe has a password of 1959. Well, because we know that 60% of users reuse their passwords, and obviously, Staples is not the most high-value account. It's what is more valuable is John's email, as if you have access to someone's email, you could potentially reset all of their passwords. So the prize is John's Gmail account, but Gmail hasn't been hacked recently, so the attacker is there's nothing he can do. Well, actually, what he can do is just attempt the same password from this previous data breach and attempt it on Gmail. And this will actually surprisingly work, because we know that people reuse passwords. So why go through all the work of trying to hack Gmail when you can just use a password that's already been breached? And this is very concerning, as there are breaches across the board, and there can be breaches that none of us know about on an account that we barely even utilize. And that same password we're using for a very high value account, such as banking or email. And also it's very dangerous because it doesn't require any IT infrastructure, like any heavy computing, for example, to complete, as you're just using a previously discovered password. Now, to prevent this password reuse, many people recommend the use of a password manager. However, password managers have their own issues as well. This is because password managers have depend. Their main authentication method is, again, an email and a password. So for instance, if you said, okay, I'm going to move all my passwords to a password manager such as LastPass, but then you make the password to LastPass very easy, like password 123 exclamation point, you've effectively just made the issue worse. As in now, if an attacker attacks your password manager, he has access to all of your passwords, not just one account. And this credential stuffing attack, which we were just mentioning, can also be utilized against password managers. So password managers are not bad, but you have to make sure that you're not just reliving the problem. Instead, use a unique password that is long and complicated so an attacker cannot guess your password manager password. And lastly, we have a completely different form of attack. Instead of an active role, you have a passive role. Keyloggers are software or hardware solutions that will record every keystroke, which potentially can be very detrimental to a user's security simply because imagine everything you type is being recorded. Social security numbers, passwords, usernames, email communications, credit card numbers with the CVV, all of that will be captured just given enough time. And this is extremely critical in public computing. Imagine a library, an airport with a shared computer device. Most of us are not looking at the USB ports to see if there's any sort of weird device. And as we see on the screen, this is a very small USB. This is a keylogger that you can purchase. This would not seem very suspicious. It just looks like a normal USB. Maybe someone left their Logitech keyboard connected. Nothing, not a big deal. But instead, it's actually recording all of your keystrokes. So this is another form of attack that also has to be looked at. And also, and there is one mitigation that we'll talk about later in which can help decrease the impact of a keylogger attack. So after we discuss these different attacks, let's talk about three mitigations that we can implement if there are us that are going to be security professionals in an organization to prevent the widespread attacks that we just seen before. The first one is password policies. Of course, the most optimal scenario, almost everything we were talking about today, was passwords. If we could just get rid of passwords, everything would be pretty much good. But we can't do that right now. It's not possible. It's not every application can support removing passwords. So instead, an organization can move towards making stronger passwords. And we can utilize guidelines from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which give a few guidelines on what you should implement for your passwords. One, minimum of 8 characters. This is to prevent a brute force attack. For example, every character adds more and more complication, as that means more and more potential passwords, which means a longer time to crack. Also, you have make sure that there are no complexity requirements. This is actually strange, as you most of us may feel that we've seen websites where they say you need one number, one letter, one capital, and one symbol. But instead, this is can actually, one, it's very predictable. Even though everyone knows we're going to use a capital letter is going to make it a little bit more complicated. But in reality, most of us probably agree that we put the capital letter in the first digit or the number, for example. It's very predictable. And also what this will make is that any form of passphrase, for example, 3 random words such as animation, park, or and tablet, 3 random words, long amount of characters, it's going to make it a little bit more, it's going to deter someone from using that, as even though that's a strong password, it's not necessarily, now you have to add a symbol, which may make a person not want to use a passphrase. And the last thing that you would want to make sure in any password policy is that your passwords are compared to a blacklist, including dictionary words from previous breaches or just any word that's commonly in the dictionary. Make sure that none of your users are using it. Now, if an organization can implement it, the next form, of course, is FIDO. FIDO is Fast ID Online. That's what it stands for. And it's a standard for web authentication without the need for passwords. If a company can implement this, this is extremely important. Extremely useful, as it uses public key cryptography instead of utilizing passwords, which means it can't be phished, can't be guessed, and it comes in multiple different form factors, including hardware keys, as we see on the screen, and biometrics. Of course, not every application supports FIDO, but if you can implement it in your organization, it will be definitely a good step towards a better security posture. And lastly, we've probably all now experienced this logging into Purdue as they made it mandatory, is we have multi-factor authentication. Multi-factor authentication is an important step to potentially, and I emphasize potentially, stop an attacker. Now, why do I say potentially? Well, because multi-factor authentication is not necessarily foolproof, for example, because not every form of multi-factor authentication is secure. For example, email multi-factor authentication is not necessarily the most secure, because imagine if your email account was breached, as we just saw earlier in the credential stuffing attack. Even though you have multi-factor authentication, your codes are coming straight to the attacker anyway. It's basically useless. And with SMS multi-factor authentication, there's a way for an attacker to steal your phone number. They just have to call this is called SIM swapping, and an attacker can call your mobile provider, act like they're you, say that I lost my SIM card, ship it out to this address, and now they have your phone number. The best way to implement multi-factor authentication is utilizing maybe a hardware key or an authenticator app, which it's harder to attack. Not impossible, of course, but implementing multi-factor authentication can add another layer of protection, especially against keyloggers, as even if a keylogger was to record your password, they can't use the code after you've used it. So it can decrease the impact of an attack. So, and that concludes the presentation. It was a lot to talk about and not a lot of time, but if anyone has any questions, this is the question section.
I did have a question.
Great, yes.
So, with ancient civilizations, we aren't keeping any passwords or anything. Instead, okay. We're doing what's called a magic token.
Okay.
Which is, you know, you just email or you sign in with Google or Facebook or whatever. Okay. So in that case, people would want to secure their email and the Facebook sign-in or Google sign-in. And as far as Google sign-in goes, is that hackable?
Google, okay. You meaning signing into Google. Well,
with just, no. You know, you can sign in with Google and you Correct. Just pick an account and whatnot.
Yes, I think I understand what you mean. In this case, what you're transferring the responsibility for authentication from your end over to Google, which means that it is, which is a good strategy. The only, of course, but what could be attacked is the Gmail account. As for example, if a user uses their Gmail account and it doesn't have a good password, for instance, it doesn't have multi-factor authentication, then that account itself could be targeted. So it just transfers the responsibility. And depending on the circumstances, let's just say Google made a rule that passwords have to be a certain length. It may increase the security than if you did it on your own, but it still could be attacked like any other account. It just transfers the responsibility and may make it less susceptible to a larger attack because Google is less likely to be attacked than maybe a smaller company, for instance.
Right. Yep, I agree. I wish that more sites would allow you to use phrases that you come up with to log in with numbers and special characters and all that. There's another school that I am going to that has that ability, and I love it because it's not something that anybody can guess or put into a dictionary, like you were saying.
I agree. Yes. Good recommendation is instead of utilizing like the standard passwords that password managers recommend is to utilize, actually password managers have this feature where they will automatically create like multi-word phrases with completely random dictionary words. I know Bitwarden has that. I think probably 1Password has it as well. And if anyone else has a password manager, probably you can all attest to this. But utilizing 3 to 4 or 5 words in a random in a word in a row, like for example, keyboard, car, hotel, tree, would be very hard to guess. 5 random words when no relation to each other.
But it'd be very hard to remember too.
it's hard to remember, but when we compare it to password managers where they want to make it where it's like XYZ !! Hashtag, it's a little bit easier. And that's why utilizing password manager can allow it to be easily remembered.
Yeah, agreed.
I think I saw Charles raise his hand earlier, but I didn't know if he had a question as well.
We were talking about keyloggers and guessing passwords that way. Have you ever used anything like Spybot Search and Destroy or anything like that to kill off keyloggers? What's your thoughts on those?
I personally not use it. That would be very interesting to find out more about it. But yeah, I've actually never utilized the tool, but I would definitely, if you could send me a link to or the name of it so I can look it up later, that would be great.
All right. Any more questions for Brian? All right. That was great, Brian. Excellent job.
Thank you.
I tell my students all the time, the same things, everything you covered, I tell them every time, because it's like they'll have a less chance of hacking you if they can't get through. If you got something like 123 password, you're the first to go. let's see. Charles Westfall, are you ready?
Yeah, if I can figure out how to get this thing to open up correctly. I have a video embedded, so I'm not sure exactly how to do that.
So when you share, make sure that you toggle the use your include computer sound. You'll want to choose the screen that has your PowerPoint open. That way, when you hit that, there's a, if it's embedded, then it'll just go ahead and start and we'll be able to hear everything.
Can you see my screen with the slideshow at all?
Yes.
Okay. It'll be later on for the video.
Okay.
So for my presentation, I'm going to talk about quantum computing in regards to cybersecurity. My name's Charles Westfall. The agenda for my presentation is comparing today's supercomputers against quantum computers with today's encryption standards, how quantum computers will help crack normal encryption, quantum computers becoming mainstream, how quantum computing or computers will help with cybersecurity, where we stand right now in questions. Comparing today's supercomputers against quantum computers with today's encryption standards. Well, comparing the two, if you look at how long it would take a supercomputer to crack ASE 256 encryption is millions to billions of years. However, with enough systems linked together, it could bring down the years that it would take, but not like quantum computers could. And so far, according to research, ASE 256 has not been broken with a brute force attack. They say it's not possible, and even with today's supercomputers, a single one would need massive amounts of time to even try a brute force attack on that. Now, with the quantum computer, it would, to crack ASE 256 encryption with enough qubits, it would take a few seconds to a few minutes at most. To me, that's a scary thought when you compare it to a regular computer. Luckily, at this point, most quantum computers possess only a few dozen qubits, which is not enough to pose a threat to 256 encryption. Quantum computers, how will they crack normal encryption using Shor's algorithm? Shor's algorithm is what quantum computers use to crack encryptions of today, which means before they are mainstream, they'll need to be new encryption standards created for post-quantum computing world. This is a graphic of Shor's algorithm using it as a brute force attack. I'm not going to say I understand most of it because I read a little bit out of it, and it's based on quantum mechanics. So it's a heavy deal to actually try and learn. Quantum computers becoming mainstream. We're looking at how they are right now. They're doing research, there's different ideas of when they'll be ready for consumer sales. The biggest problems right now are how big they are and how many stable qubits can be created. They say the longest or the farthest out that they're going to be ready for consumer sales is 2070. Before this happens, there are going to be a few things that has to happen. For instance, we need to have enough stable qubits for each system. They need to reduce in size because right now about the size of a building. And the biggest thing is we need to have encryption standards that will protect against quantum computers. How can quantum computers help with cybersecurity? The new encryption. Quantum computing will bring about new encryption standards, such as quantum encryption. According to Alexander Gillis, quantum cryptography is a system that is secure against being compromised without the knowledge of the sender or receiver. This is an image of the quantum cryptography explained. It's like the one they use for regular encryption, showing Alice and Bob and the encryption, how it does it. But this one is actually all based on quantum computing, so it's quantum mechanics. Again, I'm not going to say I understand much of this yet. It's been very interesting to try and learn about. And here's the video, if it'll play, on how quantum cryptography works.
Math might not offer the security you need, but physics might. Classical cryptography that encrypts messages with mathematical equations is secure enough for classical computing, but with the emergence of quantum computing, it may not be enough protection. That's where quantum cryptography comes in. It uses physics instead of math. Here, we'll talk about why quantum cryptography is so secure. But despite the advantages, there are still limits and challenges to quantum cryptography and quantum key distribution. Read about how one company is tackling the quantum security front in the link above or description below. Quantum cryptography uses particles of light, or photons, to transmit cryptographic keys over fiber optic wire. The photons represent binary bits, aka zeros and ones. It's a completely secure system because of these properties of quantum mechanics. Particles can exist in more than one place or state at a time. A quantum property cannot be observed without changing or disturbing it. And whole particles cannot be copied. Quantum cryptography follows a model developed in 1984 that goes like this. Alice wishes to send Bob a message. Alice initiates the message, sending Bob a key, or a stream of photons. But the photons first pass through a polarizer, polarizing each photon in a certain state, horizontal, vertical, diagonal to the right, or diagonal to the left. As Bob receives the photons, he doesn't know the correct polarization, so he randomly uses one of two beam splitters to read each photon's polarization and decipher the key. Alice and Bob can then compare the splitter they used. The photons read with the wrong splitter are discarded, and the remaining sequence is the key. If there is an eavesdropper present who has the same tools as Bob, they would not only have the disadvantage of not being able to compare their results with Alice, but they would also change the photon positions that Alice and Bob expect to see, so they would blow their cover. It's impossible to measure the quantum state of a system without disturbing it. In theory, QKD is unhackable. After keys are exchanged between the involved parties, there is little concern that a malicious actor could decode the data without the key. What do you think? Is quantum cryptography the answer to the quantum computing threat? Share your thoughts in the comments, and be sure to hit that like button.
Now, where are we standing right now? You know, normal computers are everyday mainstream systems that are used across the globe, people and companies. They started out being as big as a building within a few decades, or so small they can fit in backpacks, pockets, even on your wrist to cover a few of the smaller devices. And that all only took a few decades to happen. Quantum computers right now, they're being developed to where they can be stable enough. So right now, there's not enough stable qubits for a quantum computer to be fault tolerant enough to be considered for consumer sales. And like I said earlier, the best guess right now is a quantum computer with enough of the stable qubits to pose a threat to the current encryption is around 2070. So we still have around 40 years or so before we really have to worry about that. And right now, the most stable quantum computer only has around 60 stable qubits. So they'd need thousands of stable qubits to even be a threat to ASE 256? Any questions?
Any questions? I'm glad you brought up the fact that how big those are, because I was wondering, this is not going to be something on everybody's, you know, in everybody's office anytime soon.
For probably a couple decades after.
Right. I'm thinking, when can I get a quantum computer? Not in my backyard, maybe.
It's just like with, you know, the old, when original computers came out, they were as big as a building. Exactly. Then they went from a big as a building to an entire room. Within a couple decades, they were down from that size all the way down to something you can wear on your wrist. I mean, it's just
take a moment.
Yeah, it's just how fast.
A minute or two, right? I mean,
and if you look at technology of today, how fast it's actually changing.
Exactly. What's a decade in IT? Yeah.
Pretty much nothing.
Right. Changes so fast.
Yep. So I guess there's no questions.
All righty. Well, excellent job. Very good.
Thank you.
Great information, definitely. Let's see. Blake, are you ready?
Hello. I am.
All righty.
Okay. Is that working?
Yes, I can see it.
Okay. This presentation is going to be about the present and future relationship between AI and cybersecurity. The first section will be just quickly about what AI is and how it works. The second section will be about current and future applications of AI for cybersecurity purposes. Third is cyber threats that use AI. And finally, just some general applications of AI that will have large effects on security and technology overall. So first, an introduction to AI. AI stands for artificial intelligence. It's a general term that refers to any computer program that does something that used to need a human. That's not a very useful definition, though, because that covers a lot of programs nowadays. So when you hear AI now, it's usually going to mean machine learning. This is important because it can learn, which lets it solve a lot of problems that traditional programs cannot. So traditional programs have their functionality programmed in, but AI has its ability to learn programmed in. So again, modern AI uses machine learning to learn and reinforce its understanding. It's the backbone of modern AI. It works by, you feed the AI lots and lots of data through various formats. It could be text or images or audio, depending on the AI. The AI will take its best guess at what the classifying the data you give it. And if it's correct or incorrect, depending, it'll go back through its program and rewrite itself to be more accurate next time. So eventually, after you train it with lots and lots of training data, it will get to the point where it can satisfactorily solve its problem. Deep learning is an expanded version of machine learning that stacks multiple machine learning models on top of themselves. And allows it to solve more complicated problems than a single machine learning model. So AI is useful because it has a ability to solve problems that we don't exactly know how to solve ourselves. I mean, how do we exactly recognize language or recognize what a cat looks like? We can't really tell the computer this, so we give the computer the ability to learn and it figures it out itself. or say a stop sign in the world for a self-driving car, you could try and create a program that would recognize the sides of the sign, recognize the text. There are many issues, like maybe the sign is faded or it's dark out or it's far away. So it's a complex problem to recognize this. So we let the computer solve it itself. Another example of a complicated problem the AI is good at solving is language, or just working with language, both recognition and generation, because languages are more complex, just like image processing. So this slide is about the artificial side of artificial intelligence. I'm going to tell a story that I've heard about artificial intelligence. There was a study in which AI would look at test results from patients, and it was looking to diagnose tuberculosis. And it did so with a higher accuracy than actual human doctors. So clearly the AI found a way to recognize tuberculosis in these test results that we just didn't know about, right? Well, after reverse engineering the data and using A/B testing, they found out that the AI was looking at the age of the machine that did the test. And it was just a coincidence that the older machines would take the results that did test positive. So that highlights two problems with AI. First, it's a black box program. We don't know how AI gets the results it gets. We just know that we have an input, it figures out something, and it gives us the output we want. So our best bet to try and figure out how the AI works is you feed it slightly different things. This is A/B testing. You change one small thing in the input, see what it means in the output, and enough of that, you can figure out how it works. And this also highlights another issue. AI can't, it's artificial. It can't make logical leaps like we can. You show any human this data, and they'll know that the age of the machine doing the test has no effect of whether the person actually has tuberculosis. That's just a coincidence, but the machine doesn't know that. It's just another data point. So these problems mean the AI isn't suited for every task, and we need to be careful how we use it. And just how we use it as a tool. So AI has become a hot button topic recently, but it has been in use for a long time. I think the most obvious common application we've seen it in is Google Translate. Again, you know, working with language. Another common use are recommendation engines. These are things that say, like, you may like this on websites like YouTube or Amazon. They've taken data from across the website, data from your interaction, what you've clicked on, what other users do, and they feed that into the AI to generate what's most likely that you'll like. And of course, there's generative AI, which has become more commonplace with AI chatbots, GPT, image chatbots as well. And you're also seeing code generation popping up as well. And of course, AI can be used in cybersecurity. Takes us to our next section here. So one of AI's strengths is its ability to continuously learn from what it's exposed to. And this works very well for threat detection because it automatically help itself evolve to recognize new and changing threats. And this reduces the burden on employees. It's also already in use detecting financial fraud because it's good at detecting things that are out of the ordinary. So big data is any amount of data that's just in a very large amount. These are things from Internet of Things devices, online commerce, and yes, security tools. It's very difficult for a human to understand itself. It's just large data, and on the scale that we can view it, it's not valuable. So AI can sift through it and generate trends, patterns that are actually useful to us. Again, AI continuously learns and updates, so this is good for signatures, recognizing attacks and malware. So this is very specifically a benefit for cybersecurity. Also authentication. Again, it recognizes passwords. Well, it recognizes patterns. And it can be and is used in biometric recognition. So it is an alternative to passwords. It's also any kind of pattern can be recognized. Even their actions, like someone's typing style or how they move their mouse on the screen, it may be distinct enough to where it could be used as an authentication method. And just like Brian's presentation, the more alternatives that we get to passwords, the better. And of course, using AI removes human error. Of course, AI isn't perfect, as we know, but we can improve the downsides and adjust how we use it to reduce downsides as well, whereas you can never truly remove human error. And section 3 is AI in use as a cyber threat. So AI is already used for cyber attacks, can automatically discover vulnerable systems and launch attacks against them. And in an ongoing cyber attack, it can look at the system, look at the progress made in the cyber attack, and generate the next best step to take for the attacker to continue working towards their goals. So, because AI is used in cyber attacks, we also need to use it to bolster cybersecurity controls. Everyone knows what phishing is. It's sending out a ton of convincing-looking emails to a lot of people in order to try to get some of them to click on them. Spear phishing is a subset of it, in which the emails are handcrafted to be more convincing, and sent to a smaller group of people for a higher success rate. With AI, it can automatically create these, and they can be convincing, personalized with data pulled from all over. You can use convincing text and image generation as well, and it might become more commonplace for more people. Next is deepfakes. Everyone's also heard of deepfakes, I believe. The ability for AI to generate people's likenesses, whether it's their faces or their voices, has many, many malicious applications that could be used in social engineering attacks. It could be used against biometric recognition. And of course, it could be used to tarnish reputations of people. And ultimately end up in being able to believe what you see even less on the internet. Data poisoning is personally the most interesting part of AI. Because an AI is so sensitive to its training data, that's its entire understanding, quote unquote, of the world. If this data is compromised and poisoned, then the AI is completely, its function is completely altered. So perhaps chatbot could prefer certain opinions, could be used in silencing opinions. Threat detection AI could see specific cyber attacks as safe to give a bad actor a way in, a self-driving car could suddenly stop recognizing stop signs. It's a sensitive process. So it'll be a huge aspect of the supply chain security subset. And finally, for this section, we have malicious code generation. I believe GitHub just recently released their Copilot subscription service, which integrates an AI that will generate some code right into your IDE. So, of course, that's a good thing, but it can also be used to generate malicious code. This likely won't affect, you know, the absolute top of cyber attacks because, well, they already know how to do these things. But this will only lower the bar even more. And this final section is general AI-driven technologies that will have a large effect on the world and, of course, the security field. More generative AI. It's recently seen a boom. It's already being implemented into software development, and it's going to find its way into other fields too. This will increase productivity overall, and consumers will see the end benefit. Going to change a lot of industries. Self-driving vehicles is, of course, another aspect that just completely relies on AI. They'll completely alter the transportation sector, which will change the economy. And this is also a huge future landscape for cybersecurity. The threat of a self-driving vehicle becoming compromised is massive. They, of course, pose a giant threat to safety, but likely self-driving vehicles will take over a large section of shipping. So you could see that could have a large effect on commerce as well. And finally, cyber warfare. It's already here, it already exists, and AI will continue to play a role in it as well. It is likely equivalent to cybersecurity, whereas cyber warfare's real-world equivalent is warfare, and general, or your typical cybersecurity thought, its real-world complement is just crime. And AI will have effects on that, just as it has effects on cybersecurity, but it'll also have effects on decision-making, and once that's accepted, that could change things as well. And that is all for this presentation. Are there any questions or anything needs to be clarified and anything you'd like to add? And of course, thanks for listening. Yes, Angela?
Yeah, no questions, but, you know, I use AI all the time in front-end development. ChatGPT for JavaScript, but like I said, in the chat, what it generates, you have to debug. So that goes back to what you said about like Copilot being potentially able to generate malicious code. I don't think anybody should be able to use it unless they know what they're doing.
That is true.
I use it all the time for image generation. I have one that generates songs, just depending on what genre you want. I have it for writing. I have it for almost every aspect of front-end development that you would need. So to me, it's a useful tool.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm glad that you get to worry about the bad things with it.
Great job.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. Okay, so no more questions. All right. That was awesome. All right, we have Sean. Are you ready?
I think so. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, let me see. Share audio. Share a tab or screen instead. Okay. Entire screen. Ah, got it. Sorry, this is the first time I've done this. So share your system. Okay,
cool. No worries.
Okay, I think this is going to work. Do you see my screen?
I do.
Okay. Yeah, I'm presenting cloud computing with AWS. I probably should have called it cloud computing and AWS because I realized when I was writing this, I'm not going to be able to explain AWS unless I explain the fundamentals of cloud computing. I'm sure there's plenty of people here that don't have a background in cloud computing. So I structured it where half of it is going to be basically cloud computing fundamentals, and the other ones are going to be AWS services that you'll use as a beginner. So again, my name's Sean, and here we go. Let's see. Agenda, cloud computing history, cloud architecture, cloud models, AWS overview, compute services, storage services, and database services. Cloud computing history, a brief summary. So what is cloud computing? Cloud computing is a technology for using the resources of another device via an internet connection. And this can go both ways. Typically when we think of cloud computing, we think about pulling somebody's resources from a data center to your computer or whatever you're running. And it could actually go the other way. You could actually go peer-to-peer and share your own resources. So that's also an option. A lot of people don't know that. It uses a combination of x86 architecture mixed with virtualization, modern hardware, large bandwidth capabilities, and specialized software to create the capability for cloud computing to exist. So before there was really the hardware and the bandwidth capabilities, we already had virtualization. I believe it came out in an iteration of Windows Server. I can't really remember. I think it might have been 2008. It was somewhere around there, 2007, where they created software that allowed you to use all of the resources that you're not using. So that's basically what, and to do that, it would make a nano server. So very low resource intensive servers that you can use to do specific things. Eventually, we got high-speed internet, and the bandwidth increased, and that's what really allowed us to push and pull the type of resources that we can now through an internet connection. The cloud is simply a data center filled with servers and networking equipment. Specialized software then segments resources from the hardware in the data center so they can be packaged by a cloud service for use. So what this looks like, if you can imagine a data center, it's just a room full of servers and network gear. So you got routers, switches, all that stuff. And what it does is they have specialized software that takes resources from those devices. Those resources are then consumed by the cloud services. So when you go, I'll talk about this later, but when you spin up an AWS cloud instance or virtual machine from AWS, it's using resources, and those resources are coming from this type of workflow. Through the cloud, though the cloud was technically started by Oracle introducing software as a service, the cloud as we know it was created by Amazon when they rolled out infrastructure as a service. So no one really thought about cloud computing when software as a service came around. Businesses weren't adopting it in the way that they were once they can completely replace a lot of their on-premise infrastructure. So that was such a huge cost reduction that it didn't really become this huge thing until Amazon did this. Okay. Types of cloud computing architecture. So you have three different types: a public cloud, private cloud, and a hybrid cloud. So a public cloud uses hardware that is stored with other cloud customers. For example, servers and networking equipment. So like I explained before, a data center, a cloud is just a giant data center filled with servers, networking equipment. Now, those resources, like I said, are segmented. Now, one device could have customers, or one device could be giving resources out to many different customers. And that is why it's public. You're sharing a device, in essence. The good thing about this is that it has really low overhead costs. It's a pay-as-you-go model. The scalability is extremely high. You know, there are no known limits because no one has, you know, dropped $1 trillion to use every single resource in the AWS data center. But, you know, so for all intents and purposes, it is infinite. And there are security concerns due to the fact that you're using shared hardware. So a lot of people, namely the government, does not like that. You know, they're not going to do that. I work for a large government contractor, and they have their own private clouds, and that's mandated. So if you're going to have anything, you know, government proprietary data, it's going to be sitting on a private cloud that can get audited by the government. Now, so let's get to the private cloud. It uses hardware in a data center, a cloud data center, which is allocated to your organization only, which means you're not sharing that hardware with other people. In fact, a lot of times you're not sharing that data center with a lot of people. You probably will have your own, depending on, you know, how the size of your organization. But because of this, it's extremely secure, but obviously the costs are higher. And there is lower scalability because you have a certain amount of resources, right? So you have a data center. You don't have two data centers. You have one, unless you want to buy two. Obviously, you can do that. But it doesn't scale fast. So it's not like you can – it's you can't scale in terms of bursting like you would on a public cloud. So that's why the hybrid cloud exists. It's the best of both worlds. It allows you the flexibility to use public and private clouds however you see fit. This means you can mix and match. If you want all your data on the back end sitting in a private data center, you can do that. And then all the front end stuff can be public or mix and match. You know, you can do literally whatever you want. AWS will let you do that. So I said, for example, you can leverage the bursting and scaling of a public cloud with the heightened security of a private cloud. And that's what most businesses do. In fact, most large businesses run the hybrid cloud model. I think it's something like 80%. It's probably more now, but the last time I checked, it was about 80%. Again, most large businesses use this model, and the downside is it has a very high complexity. So it's not easy to set up or architect a cloud like this. It's got a lot of moving parts, and you know, there's a downside to that as well, right? The security downside. If there's a lot of moving parts, there's a lot of room for error. But this is the model that's adopted by most of the large businesses in this country. Okay, cloud computing models. So you have software as a service. I think that was touched on already today. Platform as a service and infrastructure as a service. Software as a service is a cloud model which provides a cloud-based application to users. An example of this is Gmail. I think somebody noted the Google Workspace suite. That's a great example of which Gmail is now a part of. And it has very limited risk to the customer because they manage pretty much everything. So if you're the customer, there's not much you have to worry about in terms of security or anything like that. Now, as we go up from level to level here, the risk to the customer is going to increase. So platform as a service, it's a cloud model, which provides a cloud-based virtual computing platform, and you typically use this in development environments or thin client software. So like a Google Chromebook is a good example of this. Or any, you know, if you want to take a really old laptop and run a virtual machine on it, that would be a good use case. And a development environment. Back in the day, they used to have production networks and development networks. And what that did was it segregated basically all the resources in your company. Anything on dev was that's where they tested everything to be moved to the production network. And the production network is just the network that everyone uses. That's the one that's in production. Because of that, you know, obviously there's huge downsides of that, and it's extremely costly to do that. And there was always security concerns. But with this is, you know, a platform as a service, you can instantly set up whatever type of development network you want, or whatever type of development platform you want. If you want to run Windows, Linux, you know, you name it, with all sorts of development tools, it doesn't matter. They have them all. You can just instantly do that, and it's very cool. It saves companies tons and tons of money. Now, infrastructure as a service. So infrastructure as a service is what is basically controlled the least by AWS and the most by you, which means you assume the most risk. So AWS, a cloud model in which you replace your servers and networking gear with virtualized solutions. So if you've ever been in a company, you walked in their network room, you see a bunch of servers, patch panels, routers, switches, firewalls, all that stuff is virtualized. So that's what infrastructure as a service means. It means you are virtualizing all of that infrastructure. Now, because you're the one configuring it, well, you can be. They have solutions for that. But let's say you are taking on the risk of doing all this yourself using services that you manage. There's a huge room for error. But, you know, again, it saves companies a ton and ton of money to do this. So it's widely used, and it's considered the birth of the cloud as we know it. Okay, so let's talk about Amazon Web Services. That's what AWS stands for. It is the largest third-party cloud provider, started in 2006. So they start providing their services to businesses strictly in about 2006. I think they opened it up to the public a little bit later. It has the largest coverage. It has over 100 data centers globally, 99 availability zones, 400 edge locations, which are just basically small data centers that you can use to cache information. So if latency is an issue, you use an edge location to cache some of your stuff that people are going to frequently be using, any data that people are going to use. All of which can be found in 245 countries, which is quite a few. So they're the biggest. Over 200 services. They have over 200 services in their catalog, which cover every possible use case, including the new no-code field, which is an emergent workflow that harnesses AI to produce an application without end user needing to know any coding language. So I think somebody talked about this earlier as well. This is going to be the norm. Obviously it's not perfect, but it's moving in that direction. I think Microsoft Azure has one, but they don't have it quite like this. AWS right now has the best services by far, where you can sit down and make an entire front end. And I think maybe I'll just do that in one of the future weeks to show you guys, but you don't need to do anything. If you know how to set up or use the AWS CLI, you can host a web page pretty quick. Let's see, it owns 32% of the cloud market share, and it's about the big three, which is Amazon AWS, Microsoft Azure, and Google Cloud, they all are separated by about 10%. So Microsoft is about 20-ish percent, and then Google is about 10. And all the rest is like Oracle and all these other small, tiny cloud providers. Okay, and AWS specializes in cost optimization and use case based cloud architecture. Yeah, that was hard to say. So people say that, you know, each of these cloud companies have benefits over one another. They say Microsoft Azure is the most user-friendly. I definitely don't think so. I think that it has one of the most convoluted consoles available. And I think the real benefit of Azure is they get you on licensing. So they get you on all the Microsoft licensing. They cut you really good deals to save you money there. And Google is used for startups primarily. They do cost optimization as well, but they're more focused on smaller scale production. And AWS is known, again, for use case. So they have the most options in terms of whatever you think of or whatever use case that you can possibly come up with in your head. They have a service for it already. And, you know, I have this big convoluted speech on how they kind of map all this out because, you know, there's 200 services. But basically, they have a service for every level of expertise. So if you want to, you know, do everything yourself, that they have a service for that. If you want to do some things yourself, they have a service for that. If you want to do nothing yourself, they have a service for that. And in every single type of use case too, which is why they have so many services. So I have a little video from AWS letting them pitch themselves to you. So sit back and relax.
AWS is the world's most comprehensive and broadly adopted cloud platform. Millions of customers trust AWS to power their infrastructure and applications. Organizations of every type and size are using AWS to lower costs, become more agile, and innovate faster. AWS provides on-demand delivery of technology services via the internet with pay-as-you-go pricing. You can use these services to build and run virtually any type of application without upfront costs or ongoing commitments. You only pay for what you use. AWS gives you more services and more features within those services than any other cloud provider. This makes it faster, easier, and more cost-effective to move your existing applications to the cloud and to build anything you can imagine. From infrastructure technologies like compute, storage, and databases, to emerging technologies such as machine learning and artificial intelligence, data lakes and analytics, and Internet of Things. Building on AWS means you can choose the right tool for the job. For example, AWS offers the widest variety of databases that are purpose-built for different types of applications. With AWS, you can leverage the latest technologies to experiment and innovate more quickly. We are continually accelerating our pace of innovation to invent entirely new technologies you can use to transform your business. Like pioneering the serverless computing space with the launch of AWS Lambda, which lets developers run their code without provisioning or managing servers. And AWS built Amazon SageMaker, a fully managed machine learning service that empowers everyday developers and scientists to use machine learning without any previous experience. We are constantly expanding our global network of AWS regions, so you can access AWS services to build and run your applications from anywhere in the world. Each of these regions has multiple availability zones that are physically separated from each other and connected by low latency, high throughput, and highly redundant networking. This makes it easy to design and operate applications that are scalable, fault tolerant, and highly available. Our infrastructure is built to satisfy the security standards of the most risk-sensitive organizations. You also have access to the AWS Partner Network, which has thousands of systems integrators who specialize in AWS services, and tens of thousands of independent software vendors who adapt their technology to work on AWS. With the largest community of customers across every industry, AWS has unmatched experience and operational expertise you can depend upon for your most important applications and every imaginable use case.
All right, back to the fun stuff. So now let's talk about some of the services. So compute services. Compute is just another fancy word for computer, CPU and RAM resources. So they separate them into three different categories. You have instances, which is just their term for virtual machines, containers, and serverless. So the most basic offering that they have is Elastic Compute Cloud, EC2 instances. And they auto-scale automatically. And they allow the most customization. So you can do whatever you want with these things, but you're going to be the one doing it. Now, if you move to AWS LightSail, that is already pre-configured. That's just to get your workload up very quickly. And it also does it securely. So it's in a virtual private server. And it can't be used for giant monolithic applications. That would be EC2 for that. This is like a medium-sized workload, something, you know, nothing too crazy. And then AWS Batch, it just does small batch workloads, but it's fully managed. You just set it up and that's it. It does its own thing. Then you have containers. So if people don't know, containers are used by developers to basically customize whatever type of environment that they want. So, you know, if you want a snapshot of an environment to develop in, you can do that. And it also self-contains applications in whatever environment you want. So it's mostly used by as a platform as a service offering, and the main services. So there's a lot of services that go with each of these, and I'm only doing the main ones just to save some time. Amazon Elastic Container Service. It supports Docker containers and it's fully managed. So if anybody used Docker before, you're probably going to understand what this is like, as opposed to Kubernetes, which is extremely complex. It's open source and it's used for multi-cloud uses. So very, very big, complex, you know, like that hybrid model that I was talking about, they would probably be using this at some point. And then you have AWS Fargate, which is just the serverless option. I probably should explain what serverless was, but it's basically infrastructure via code. You don't have to go into the console. You just write a script and it does that. And you can integrate applications with that. And then now we have serverless. So AWS Lambda is their compute serverless solution. It's a complete serverless compute option with the capabilities of an EC2 instance. So it has all of the capabilities of, you know, you being able to go into the console and actually spinning up an instance, or, you know, even writing a script to do that, except it does it automatically. You don't configure anything. You don't pick whatever instance size you want. You don't do any of that. It determines what you want, and then you'd get that. So, and it auto scales. If you need more, you get more. So that's why it's serverless. You don't control it at all. You just say, I need compute for this, and you get that. Okay, storage services. Block storage. Block storage is just, you know, like the hard drive on your computer. You know, it's general purpose. And the services that they use is Elastic Block Storage or EBS and EC2 instance storage. So when you spin up an EC2 instance, that is going to be the default storage. It's going to be EBS. EC2 instance storage, which is just EBS, to be honest. It's low latency, high performance, general storage. So nothing specific. If you just need something very general, this is what you use. And we also have file system storage. So Amazon EFS, Amazon FSX, and I'm just going to say NetOnTap or NetAppOnTap, OpenZFS, and Windows File. FSX stands for File Service, File System X. Because it could be anything. This is your purpose-built service for every single type of purpose that you have. Each one of these is a different type of has a different type of use case, and I listed a few of them down there. You know, obviously, if you're using Windows, you use Windows File Server. Each of these has specific use cases. Applications which need to share. Needs shared read-write access to a bunch of different VMs. There's a use case for that in there. High availability and bursting AI. I believe that one is the NetAppOnTap one. Then we have object storage. That's AWS S3 buckets. I'm sure everybody's heard of that. Read-heavy workloads, big data situations, and machine learning. It's very versatile. You can use it for a lot of stuff. You just probably shouldn't use it for block. You know, if you need to attach storage to an instance, you're not going to use that. Object storage is for you could use that for storing pictures from a website or, you know, videos, things like that. Let's see, what do we got next is database services. And I'm going to try and speed it up because it's taking forever. Relational database. So to be clear, there's the relational database and all the rest of the categories are non-relational databases of various types. So relational database, you got Amazon Aurora. That's a serverless offering. Amazon RDS. That is the standard relational database. That's what you're going to be using. And Amazon Redshift is for big data, data lakes, things like that. All options besides Redshift are compatible with MySQL and PostgreSQL. Key value databases. This is Amazon DynamoDB. It works great for e-commerce commerce websites. That's something like you would use that for like a shopping cart. It's great for social media sites using tons of metadata. Then we have in-memory database. Amazon ElastiCache. This, I believe, is an open source offering with Memcache. Used when you need faster read speeds, and it's very simple. It's nothing fancy. Amazon Redis, however, is the apex of caching in-memory databases. It is for giant big data solutions, and it is incredibly fast. Then you have document database, Amazon Document DB. It's for storing JSON documents, and it works with MongoDB, and it's fully managed, meaning you don't have to do anything. Summary, cloud computing is the foundational technology of the foreseeable future. There would be no AI if there was no cloud computing. You need it to scale the AI. And if for scaling, the only way scaling exists really in a practical way is cloud computing. There are private, public, hybrid cloud models. There are three categories of services offered: software as a service, platform as a service, infrastructure as a service. And AWS is the largest and most comprehensive third-party cloud provider. I know a lot of people don't like them, but they're wrong. They specialize in use case-based cloud computing and cost optimization. They have an amazing free tier that I encourage everyone to try at some point. And don't be worried about blowing up your account. I've blown up a million, at least three AWS accounts when I was learning IAM a while ago. So just all you need is just make a new email. That's it. That's all you need to do. And you're going to get another year for free plus all the other freebies. So I highly recommend it if you're trying to learn it. In fact, me and my friend, we got together in 2015. We made an application and sold it, and we hosted it on AWS for free, and we barely even knew what we were doing. That's how easy it is. So I highly recommend it. Questions?
Well, what's the application you created?
It was called Docido. It got bought, and I believe they just wanted the code, pretty much, in the use case. It was called Party Mapper before that, then Docido, and then I don't know what it's called. So they bought it outright.
Is Android based or?
It was iOS based.
iOS based. Mm-hmm. Cool. Nice. Good job.
Fun stuff. Oh wait, I can't see if anyone is. Let me stop presenting.
Let's see.
Stop sharing here.
I use AWS anyways. That's my clients are all on AWS. We host everything through AWS. So, and that's we found that many companies, a lot of people know that they go to different companies to host their clients, and those companies are working through AWS. As a host. So
yeah.
So you're not only paying this, so they're actually doubling you up on hosting. So if you go to them, they're doubling the price, probably quadrupling the price, because AWS is so inexpensive.
Yeah. Yeah, so, absolutely. I mean, everybody should try it at least. I mean, it's free. The stuff that next week, so I'm working on a project right now, just putting up a serverless application, and the only thing that I didn't do is the front end. So the front end was all done, all the JavaScript files were there. I had to modify like a few things, but I mean, I got that thing up. I'm almost done. I'd say total is probably going to take me 10 hours. And I mean, complete identity federation, which is something Angela was talking about earlier in terms of security, all of that is going to be set up. So, you know, that's how good it is. And yeah.
Awesome.
Sorry.
Wow.
I like it.
when are you done? 23rd?
I am done. No. And I think January 16th.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe we can put something together for interns to learn from, to train from on what you know.
Yeah.
Using AWS, because then they can get onto the AWS free for a year and they can work on the project that we come up with.
That sounds good.
All right. I like it. Awesome. All right. Lastly on my list, unless somebody wants to jump in, because I know that I have a couple people that need to make this up before the 23rd, which is Saturday. But Derek, are you ready?
Yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
I can, and I see your slides.
Okay. Yep. So I'm doing mine on sorts, different kinds of algorithms that, we use in coding. Just the agenda, kind of. We've pretty much all at this point have done some kind of sort. It's a pretty good base for programming. We learn to work with tables and arrays and how to manipulate them. Yep, like I said, we work with tables and arrays and, you know, building databases and things like that, so we can sort data out. This is a bubble sort, probably one of the first ones that we tend to work on here. It's probably one of, I guess, the more, you know, kind of quick sorts, but it still has to go through the process of trying to find, you know, which one it is, and that does take some time. Quick sorts. What this does is it kind of splits it. So this would be like 70 over here. And then it splits everything. Left would be numbers less than. To the right would be numbers greater than. And then it just merges them. Quick sorts are also called merge sorts. Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's not right. But then they put them together and then they try to figure out which one, you know, ends up being the correct output. This is a merge sort, and that's kind of what this does as well. And it also combines them until it comes up with the correct solution. BOGO sort, this is one that I've done before. I ended up doing like 31 iterations one time, 17 another. It's also called a permutation sort, and it's got like a pretty good reputation for being the slowest sort, because, and most useless sort as well, because every time it does it, it basically starts over from 1 to 0. As you can see here, each one, it doesn't save any of the data. It just restarts it and restarts it and restarts it until it comes up with the correct one. All right, hopefully you all got some good information on sorts. Questions, comments, concerns?
For the layman, when are sorts used?
Sorts are used like if you want to organize data, or you know, it can even be used like an RNG. It can be used as, it's got a, quite a few different applicable abilities. But basically, I would say, you know, if you just want to sort out data, or if you want to find out, so for instance, if you want to find out how many times it takes to, or which numbers are divided most by 2 out of 100, it'll come up with, you know, it'll do the computation, and then it will output a list until it finally comes up with an iteration that comes up with an order. And you can reverse them. There's so much you can do with them. You can, they're almost, it's an endless possibility. You can reverse them. You can give different values. You can turn a 1 into 100 and 100 into a 1. So it's really about what information you're trying to find out.
Cool. Very good. Excellent. Like, anyone else have any questions for Derek? Yeah, great job. All right. Well, if no one else, last chance. If you want to get this done earlier instead of waiting until next year, you can get your, if you have it done, if you've got it created, your presentation tonight, you're welcome to jump in and get it done for another 10 hours. Right? You can do a whole new teaching thing right now. All right. Well, I thank everybody for their wonderful presentations. All the work that you've done is really appreciated. It really is. You guys have done a great job. Congratulations on getting that done. And we are at the end of the master classes, I guess, for this year. So everybody have a wonderful winter break and holiday for whichever that you what do you call it? Do whatever holiday that you guys do that you pass, and have a great new year. And I guess I will be here anyways in the internship, no matter what. I'm around, so you guys, we can always holler at each other we know how to, right, in the chat group. So be safe, and want all of you to come back in good shape and ready and all defragged and ready for next year. Put it back to the back in drive, right? Thanks, everybody.
Yep, I'll be around too, soft devs. Quantum
Yeah, we're here. We're always here.
We are stuck. We are fixtures.
We love it. We love it. Yep. That's why. Yep. Have a great night, everybody.